On December 5th, 1984, the naked body of a 16-year-old girl was found in a wooded area of Lynbrook, Long Island. The victim had been last seen leaving her job at a local roller rink about a month earlier. The medical examiner determined that the cause of death was ligature strangulation, and semen found on her vaginal swab suggested that she had been raped. By March 1985, authorities believed that this rape and murder were connected to similar disappearances, and investigators started focusing on Dennis Halstead, who was believed to have been associated with another young woman who had disappeared. John Restivo had been interviewed as part of this investigation and mentioned that he was acquainted with John Cogut, an occasional employee of his and his brother's moving business. After Cogut was given 3 polygraphs, police asserted that he lied when denying involvement with the disappearance of the 16-year-old victim. He endured 12 hours of aggressive interrogation, and eventually he cracked and signed a confession that was handwritten by one of the detectives, the 6th version of events given by Cogut, containing information all of which was previously known to investigators. According to Cogut's false confession, the victim voluntarily got into Restivo's van, where Cogut and Halstead stripped her and Halstead raped her. Further into this coerced statement, he said that when they arrived at a cemetery, Restivo also raped her and Cogut strangled her when she regained consciousness and became frantic. With the false confession and a number of hairs found in Restivo's van said to have matched the victim's, the 3 men were tried over the course of 1986. John Cogut was tried separately and convicted of rape and murder in March. Dennis Halstead and John Restivo in November. Through the concerted efforts of Centurion Ministries, Pace Law School's post-conviction clinic, private counsel, and the Innocence Project, the defense used police department property records to finally locate and test intact vaginal swabs for DNA in 2003, ultimately excluding the 3 men as the perpetrators. John Restivo spoke with us at the Atlanta Innocence Network conference to tell their horrifying story. Together, they spent over half a century in prison for a crime they did not commit. This is Wrongful Conviction with Jason Plum.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Kakadu plum is an Australian native superfood containing 100 times more vitamin C than oranges. So why have you never heard of it? PR. No one's drinking a Kakadu smoothie? I'm JB Smoove, and that was a full episode of my new podcast, Straightforward, inspired by guaranteed straightforward pricing from AT&T Fiber. Get what you want without the complicated. AT&T Fiber, live like a gigillionaire. Available wherever you get your podcast. Limited availability in select areas. Visit AT&T.com/hypergig for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18+.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. I'm especially excited today because I've got a guest who I've wanted to have on my podcast from long before I even had a podcast. So ever since I read your story in The New Yorker, John Restivo, I've been sort of in awe of your story, your case, your everything. So I'm really happy you're here.
Yeah, what a long, strange trip it's been.
Yeah, how about it? And like I always say, I'm sorry you're here, but I'm happy you're here. So And with you, Nina Morrison is a return guest on the show today. Nina is the senior staff attorney at the Innocence Project in New York. Welcome back.
Thank you, Jason. It's always so nice to be here.
And this is going to be an amazing experience for me, I think for everyone who's listening as well, mainly because of you, John. So let's get right into it. So, and yours is a New York case, right? Which makes it personal to me as a New Yorker, a lifelong New Yorker. And just by way of background, John was convicted of a rape murder along with two other innocent men and sentenced to 33 and a half years to life, could well have been executed if not for Governor Mario Cuomo blocking repeatedly the death penalty in New York State. I think that's an important thing to touch on. But let's go back to it. All these crimes we talk about are horrible. This one is particularly terrible, right? This is the rape and murder of a young girl, 16-year-old girl. And obviously, everybody wants to see those crimes solved, but they don't want to see it solved this way. I mean, when we get the wrong people locked up, whoever it is that did this was free to commit other heinous crimes. But take us back to the crime itself, and how did you first hear about it? I mean, you were at the time, you were in the moving business? What were you doing?
Yeah, I was in the moving business with my brother, right? And when young lady disappeared, we had seen articles in the newspaper. There was missing persons flyers on different store windows or telephone poles. So people in the community knew that the young lady was missing.
Which town was this?
This was in Lynbrook, New York, in Nassau County, all around, yeah. And there was a couple of articles in the newspaper. So approximately 3 weeks later, a body is found, and it's identified as being her body. And now, instead of it being a missing persons case, it's a homicide.
And this case, it's got so many layers because you have three guys, which makes it really especially tragic, because the other two guys that were convicted of the same crime that you were convicted of were just as innocent as you were, but one of them confessed.
Right.
And we know how that goes as well, but every one of those, even inside of that false confession, there's a lot of nuance to those situations. Do you want to talk about that? Because that was a guy named Kogut, right?
Well, part of the problem with the interrogation process that he was put through is that the police lied to him. And I understand, okay, the police are allowed to lie to you, but he took a lie detector test. And the police told him he failed the lie detector test. And we had experts that actually viewed the poly charts. And our experts said that, you know, he didn't lie, right, that he was telling the truth. But the detectives used that as a tool against him, you know, while this guy is being, you know, he's in a small room with a couple of these, let's call them thugs, because that's what they are. Don't get me wrong, I'm not calling all police thugs. We need the police, and I'm not saying that.
John's the son of a police officer.
So I'm not calling all police bad, but so they held that over his head saying that, okay, you lied during the polygraph test, which was an actual lie. I mean, they were lying to him, right? And their polygraph expert said, well, I don't really go by the charts. I go by the person's demeanor while I'm giving them the test.
It's an interrogation tool. It's just a tool they're using to interrogate someone. It's not, and polygraphs are not, you know, people can debate whether they have any utility for determining if someone is or is not telling the truth, but police have used them for decades as part of what they, the experts now call a guilt presumptive interrogation, where they bring somebody in, they've already decided based on these subjective factors, like I get a feeling he's not telling me the truth, or they think they have other evidence the person did it. And once they decide that the person is guilty, the interrogation is not a search for the truth, it's a search for a confession.
In the false confession, right, everything that the police had known, right, every fact that they knew, right, was incorporated into this confession, right? The young lady disappears in early November of 1984. They're interrogating Kogut in early March of 1985, and according to the police, in this false confession, there's facts coming out of color of pocketbook, color of sneakers, I mean, things that no normal person could ever remember. You know, last week, what did you have for breakfast last Monday? I mean, like, every fact that was known, even like the piece of jewelry that they recovered that she had been wearing, right? He supposedly remembers the type of jewelry. And since it was all fictitious to begin with, right, every fact that they knew was incorporated into the false confession, except one thing. The police didn't know the color blouse or shirt that she was wearing on the night she disappeared. And that's the only thing that wasn't incorporated into this false confession. So according to all of the experts, they consider this a classic false confession because no normal person would be able to actually remember all of these facts. There were just too many facts incorporated into this confession for it to be reliable.
Okay, now we know that Kogut confessed, but how did that lead to your case being brought to where it went and ultimately to you being convicted and almost executed?
The police, they incorporate my name and Dennis's name into the false confession. Because in a way, the police had us labeled as suspects. I don't believe that. We were labeled as targets. I personally believe that they were going to frame us one way or the other, right?
Why, Dennis?
I wouldn't have a clue. After Kogut confessed, falsely confessed, now my family retained a private investigator. We're trying to figure out where I was on the night this young lady disappeared. We figured out where I was through receipts because I had just purchased a house, and that weekend I was sanding the floors. I was in the house the whole night. That evening I was on the phone with my girlfriend who was pregnant. We were putting polyurethane on the floor, so she was pregnant. She couldn't be in the house. She was at her mother's, so we had phone records. We had receipts, so we knew exactly where we were, where I was, right? And Dennis was with his kids in another town, and Kogut was at a birthday party in another town. We didn't even lay eyes on each other that whole weekend. And beyond that, the three of us were never together in that van as a threesome ever. And we all had independent alibis. And by the time we got to trial, they took my independent alibi witness, because the guy that was helping me, he was a friend at the time, he was helping me sand the floors. Right? He was at the house all night. The cops pick him up off the street. They bring him in for 10 to 12 hours, and they tell him that, well, if you don't tell us what we want to hear, right, you're going to end up in jail with them. So they've actually flipped my independent alibi witness from my witness to their witness. And he actually gave damaging testimony against me at trial. And at the civil trial, during his testimony, the judge actually stopped the proceedings, had the jury removed, and told him that you're on the borderline of being charged with perjury here, because he had changed his testimony so many times, right? And when he testified at the criminal trial, he lied, right? But they wouldn't give us his original grand jury testimony. So it was always my opinion that his testimony was different from what he testified at the grand jury to what he testified 2 years later at the criminal trial. Because during that time span, the cops put so much pressure on this dude and flipped him.
Yeah, I mean, he was in an impossible situation. It doesn't excuse what he did.
No, but you're right. In a way, I felt bad for him because he was stuck in the middle of this, right? And he's under this tremendous amount of pressure by the police. And he's being told, well, if you don't tell us what we want to hear, you're going to end up in jail with him. And he sees innocent people in jail, right? And he sees how easy it was for the police to do that.
Exactly. He knows what they're capable of because he already knows you're innocent and he knows what they're doing to you. So there's no reason to not believe that they would do the same
thing. Correct. Right. And then we had the other problem with the police planting evidence in the van, and the judge, because that was a bench trial, so the judge concluded that the hairs that they intimated that were found in my van were never in the van.
Right, and Nina, let's talk about that, because that is, even by the standards of some of the crazy shit that we see in this line of work, that's going even beyond some of the misconduct.
Yeah.
You know, this is so far, they were literally pulling hairs from the corpse and then taking those hairs and putting them in the van. Like, who does a thing like that?
Yeah. Well, who does it are police who are desperate to solve a crime that has the community absolutely terrified and up in arms. So what John talked about earlier about the flyers around town, I mean, this was the mid-'80s, you know, bedroom community, suburban Long Island. The young woman who was killed in the case that John was falsely convicted in, her name was Teresa Fusco, was actually one of three young women that went missing around that time. And the other two, to this day, those crimes have never been solved.
Wow.
And for all we know, it may have been the same killer or killers in those cases. But by the time Teresa disappeared, she was missing for, what was it, John, 3 weeks? About 3 weeks before her body was found. So the terror and the paranoia that they're feeling in this town is only heightening. And the parents, the elected officials, the teachers are saying, solve this crime, solve this crime. And after she was found, naked, brutalized, in the woods, just a horrible way to go, you know, the police spent months basically bringing in every working class guy between the ages of 18 and 29 in town in and working them over, trying to see if they could find a weak spot until they get poor John Cogut, who had had a really rough life, grown up in foster care, nobody to fight for him. And even he held out for hours and hours till he finally confessed, you know, and gave a false confession that, as John said, was a classic false confession in that it had no information that the police didn't already know, so he couldn't point them to clothing or jewelry or fruits of the crime or anything about her that wasn't part of the police's knowledge, but everything they did know almost too perfectly. But when it came to the hairs, part of what was wrong with this case when they decided they were going to pin it on John and his two friends is that they had no physical evidence. There was no evidence against them, no DNA, no blood typing, nothing of hers that was ever found with them, no eyewitnesses, as far as anybody knew at the time, who had seen what vehicle she'd gotten into when she was leaving her job at a roller skating rink. And, you know, we don't say lightly that police frame people. I mean, a lot of times police will make bad mistakes, they will cut corners, they will interview witnesses in a way that's not ethical or permissible. But in this case, there is actual scientific evidence that John and his co-defendants got framed. Namely, Detective Volpe, the lead homicide detective, claimed that he found several hairs when he finally got a search warrant for John's van, the one he used for his moving jobs. He claimed that he found several hairs that were long hairs, looked just like Teresa's, and microscopically appeared to be the same as Teresa's hairs. We later did DNA and confirmed that they were, in fact, her hairs. So that would be pretty bad evidence. And normally you'd think, well, that makes John guilty. The problem was those hairs would have had to be deposited in the van during this period when John and his friends were alleged to have abducted her for just a few minutes. According to the confession, they had given her a ride and then raped her, and she was in the van for not longer, certainly no more than an hour. And then she was missing for several weeks. But the hairs came from a corpse. They had this decomposition at the roots of the hairs called postmortem root banding, which basically happens when hairs are attached to a corpse that's decomposing. And so Detective Volpe takes these hairs, and whether he planted them in the van or just put them in an envelope marked hairs from van that was back at the lab, we don't know, and doesn't really matter. But he lied under oath and said that these hairs came from the van, and it's physically impossible because she had been decomposing for several weeks when these hairs were collected. They were from her autopsy, not from the van.
I do believe that most people that are doing those jobs are doing the best they can. And we need police to keep us safe. But when you get somebody like this Volpe character who does the type of damage that he did, they have to be held to account.
Yeah. I mean, these detectives actually created a fictitious scenario after they actually botched what we think was the actual crime scene. And unbeknownst to us, the night she disappeared, a car within approximately a mile of where she was last seen was stolen. And when this car was recovered approximately a week later, they found a pair of blue striped jeans with one of the legs inside out in the back, but stuffed underneath the seat. And on the missing persons report, when she was last seen, that's what she was wearing, blue striped jeans. So the homicide cops grabbed this car, right, which was already cleaned by the owner, and the blue striped jeans were thrown out by the Limerick Police Department. So there was police reports regarding the stolen car and the blue striped jeans, right? And then there was a piece of rope missing from the car. And according to the ME, right, there was a piece of rope similar used as, what would you say, the murder weapon?
Yeah.
Right? And this was missing from the car. When they brought the owner back to the area where the car was recovered, they found the piece of rope, but they took a picture of the piece of rope, and one would think that given the significance of that, this piece of rope would be taken into evidence and vouched, and the police say it never was. So this is information that should have been turned over to the defense, and it never was, and we never found out about this information till we were in the civil litigation stage.
20-something years later.
Correct.
I was John's Innocence Project lawyer. We didn't know about this information. You know, a lot of times, as you know, and a lot of your guests have talked about, there's evidence pointing to someone's innocence. And, you know, certainly in this case, this is evidence about where the crime occurred and what type of vehicle was used, which is a huge objective lead that's different than the entire case that was against John and his co-defendants. But that is evidence. Often we learn about that when we're in post-conviction, meaning the person's been convicted and we're litigating their appeals and we're trying to exonerate them. In John's case, as he'll tell you, we cleared him with DNA and other evidence that we gathered as part of the Innocence Project and Centurion Ministries investigation of the case. But we didn't even know about this other evidence the police had of his innocence until after he was exonerated. It only came out when he had lawyers representing him in his lawsuit against the police department and the county that this all came to light. So it's a really stunning fact that you can have evidence of innocence that's hidden, possibly even from the DAs, because it was in the police file, and only come out after someone's exonerated. And so his case is a DNA exoneration case, but as with so many, there's other evidence that could have cleared him even before he went to trial.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
This is it. Your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global. Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
The 2024 presidential campaign features two candidates who are very well known to Americans. And yet, there's complexity at every turn. Criminal trials for one of those candidates. Young voters who are angry. The Campaign Moment podcast from The Washington Post gives you what matters. I'm Aaron Blake, and I'm covering my 10th election cycle. My colleagues and I have insights that you won't find anywhere else. So follow The Campaign Moment right now, wherever you're listening.
As the son of a police officer, this must have been totally surreal to you, because as much as we all grew up, I mean, when I was a son, I had, you know, ideas that I would become a policeman, right? I mean, you know, we all look up to firemen and cops. I think most boys do, right? Especially growing up, right? In the era that we grew up in. But for you, it was a very personal thing, right? You must have been very proud to have a dad who's a cop, I would think, right?
Right.
I mean, I would be. But then at the same time, I would expect that you must have thought, that because of the fact that your dad was in blue, that this wouldn't happen to you, right? And was your dad around? Was he alive at this time?
No, my father passed away in January of 84, so he wasn't around. But my father said something to me at one time while he was on the job, and he told me, if you ever have a problem with a cop, call a lawyer. And when the police brought me in and interrogated me for 20-plus hours, once I was released, I immediately called a lawyer.
Why didn't you call a lawyer at first?
They wouldn't let me leave. They took my car keys. I mean, they wouldn't let me call a lawyer. You know, I was there. I mean, they weren't letting me go anywhere. And finally, they let me go. And after 20 hours, I was so out of it, they wouldn't even let me drive home. They drove me home and drove my car home.
There's so many things wrong with this that I'm just like...
No, this is a complicated case. There's no doubt about it. And I'm just glad it's over with. But what the cops did to me, right, it's unfortunate that they can do to whoever they please. I mean, they could pick somebody out of a group, right, and make them a target, and then they fabricate a case around them, and that's exactly what they did to us. Because from day one, I requested DNA testing, and back in the 80s, mid-80s, there was no DNA testing. And back in 93, 94, 95, we had three different DNA tests done. One was inconclusive, the two other ones excluded us. And back in 95, I thought we were gonna get cut loose. I thought that was gonna be the end of the gospel. That wasn't the case. The judge
should have been one of the first DNA exonerees in the country because he was going in pro se and he had a lawyer who was helping him out for some of that time, you know, early on, and he's incredibly smart and he was researching and filing his own motions. He had a DNA test from sperm from a 16-year-old girl who was a virgin that didn't come back to him or Dennis or John Cogut. And the DA said, doesn't matter. Could have been a fourth guy, right? Fourth guy. There's no third guy. There's no second guy. There was one guy. It was his sperm, and it wasn't any of these guys. And he goes to court, and the judges back then weren't as educated as they are now about DNA and what it shows. And, you know, he had different lawyers, and they said, sorry, not giving you a new trial. And so there he was, you know, in the mid-90s, starting at square one again.
Let's just reflect on that for a second, too. So you proved with DNA that you were innocent. And they're like, yeah, it's all right, doesn't matter. I think probably everyone at home is experiencing the same, or in your car or wherever you're listening, the same thing that I'm experiencing, which is that, wait a minute, that sounds like a misprint or a misstatement. That can't really be true.
The prosecutors actually lied in their papers about the reliability of the tests. They insinuated that the test results were not reliable, which is ludicrous because there's two independent tests done by two independent labs, and they identify the same exact DNA profile. So if one lab made a mistake, how could the other lab, independent lab, make the same mistake and identify the exact same DNA profile? So when they argued in their papers that the tests weren't reliable, I mean, that was totally ludicrous, and the judge adopted all of this insanity.
And then, if I remember correctly, after they realized they weren't getting anywhere for a while, the judge was getting skeptical of the reliability argument. Then they said, well, the only thing that was tested for this last round was off of a vaginal slide, which is a glass slide that the medical examiner at autopsy makes from the cotton swab that was actually had most of the sperm and the semen on it. And it was just the one part of the slide. So maybe these three guys who we convicted, maybe their DNA was on the rest of the slide or on the swabs, and we just don't have enough material. So you had to believe two things. One, that the test was missing all of their DNA, but also that they had some crime partner, this mystery John Doe, who was the fourth guy whose name didn't come up in the confession, didn't come up from any of the informants, didn't come up from any of the witnesses, you know, who everybody had been covering up for this last 10 years, which was absurd. But the courts bought it. And so then they basically gave John a challenge, which was, prove us wrong. Prove to us that your DNA is not really there.
So,
and then we did that.
Right. In 2001, there was a small portion of sample left and they retested it using new methodology where they would be able to run that result through the federal and state databases, you know, through CODIS, right? And again, when they tested that, it comes back matching the same DNA profile that came back in the 90s.
Amazing. A miracle. And,
yeah. And they ran it through CODIS hoping that they would get a hit, right? And since they didn't get a hit, they're still maintaining that it's not reliable. Then in 2002, I met Nina Morrison. And IP took on more involvement in the case, right, and got us all independent lawyers, right? They got lawyers for Dennis, they got lawyers for John. And in early 2003, Nina and a couple of the lawyers went to inventory evidence that the police had. And lo and behold,
we were looking for photos and maps. We were looking for some old photos related to another part of our investigation. And they wouldn't just send us the photos. So we said, fine, can we come look through the boxes? So we were out there with an assistant DA who was new to the office, relatively new. And she said, yeah, let's just go look through the boxes. So go ahead, John.
So Nina and the other lawyers, they open up the boxes and they're going through the boxes. And lo and behold, they found a plastic envelope with a glass tube in it. And a swab in it, and it has the case number and Teresa Fusco's name on it, and it's vouched by Volpe. And after they insinuated all of them years that there's no samples left to be tested, it was right there in the box, you know, in the DA's office or in the police headquarters, wherever they were. And Nina seen this, and the DA seen this, and then now they had to collaborate. Okay, now where are we going to send this to have it tested? And they sent it out to have it tested. And this is a sample that was never touched. So it's in pristine condition. And
if anybody had, you know, raped her, that DNA is going to be on there. So they had said for years, well, the other guys, you know, John and his co-defendants, their DNA was there. We just burned all the samples, so we can't protest it now. And then suddenly we had this big intact swab that everybody said was gone for 15 years that was finally available. And not surprising to any of us, we tested it, and guess what? It's the same guy whose profile has been coming up again and again. But this time, because it was such a big sample, the DA's office finally, you know, that plus a whole lot of other evidence we gathered. We went out and made a presentation to them, a whole coalition of people. It really did take a village. It was my very first Innocence Project case. I was a young lawyer and very motivated, shall we say, and still am. But, you know, I was very invested in this one, and a whole bunch of us, Centurion Ministries, the Innocence Project, Adele Bernard, and then my old law school classmate, Terry Maroney, who was a lawyer at a big firm. We all did this big presentation with Barry Scheck together and got them to finally agree. They actually caved in and agreed. We didn't have to go to court. They agreed to throw out their convictions.
I'm Katya Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is it, your moment. This is your time to make your comeback with Purdue Global. When you come back with a Purdue Global degree, you create opportunity for yourself, your family, and your future. It's a degree you can be proud of, a degree that employers will trust and respect. Purdue Global offers working adults like you over 175 flexible degree programs to meet your specific career goals. These include associate, bachelor's, master's, and doctoral degrees and certificates. Purdue Global degree programs range from nursing to business to communication and more. Whatever your interest, we have the degree that will move you forward. You have the knowledge. You have the experience. Now it's time to get credit for the work you've done and earn the recognition you deserve with Purdue Global, Purdue's online university for working adults. You know you're worth it. We do too. So don't wait another second to get the degree that will take your career to the next level. Start your comeback today at purdueglobal.edu.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cb for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
The best conversations I have with my colleagues are the ones that happen when no one is looking, when we're not 100% sure yet what to write.
Hopefully, having conversations like this can help you figure out your own point of view. That's kind of our job as Washington Post opinions columnists. I'm Charles Lane, Deputy Opinion Editor.
And I'm Amanda Ripley, a contributing columnist. We're going to bring you into these conversations on a new podcast called Impromptu.
Follow Impromptu now, wherever you listen.
You had a kind of a bright future at the time, right? You had a pregnant girlfriend, right? You had a good job, right?
Right.
You had a career that was growing, and all of a sudden, you're accused and ultimately convicted of the worst crime that anyone could be convicted of, right? I think, which is the rape and murder of an underage person, child, a teenager, whatever. How did you deal with this? Like, and then you had to go through this 18 years in the maximum security prisons. I mean, can you take us through that?
In the beginning, it turned my life upside down. It turned my family's life upside down. But that being said, my family always supported me, right? My original trial lawyer always supported me, and everybody always believed in my innocence. And I had the one thing going for me that I knew that not only was I innocent, that I was framed, because I watched the evidence come out during the course of the trial, right? So I knew that I was framed. Now it was up to me to prove all of this. So I end up in a penitentiary, and I started going to the law library, and I started teaching myself how to use the books. I taught myself how to become a legal writer. I don't want to say a legal scholar, but I became a legal writer, and I started writing and writing, and I started writing letters to all kinds of organizations or individuals seeking help. And I wrote Centurion Ministries in 1987 and started corresponding with them. And then I started corresponding with the Innocence Project. And, you know, there was a lot of setbacks, you know, like, because originally when we expedited the DNA testing, the district attorney's office refused to do it. They said, there's no way. We're not going to do that. And this was in the late 80s, because DNA was first used in a criminal case, I think it was 1988 or 1989, something like that. And I think it was an Olney County case. And so I wrote my lawyer, I mean, if they're going to use this to convict somebody, why can't we use this to exonerate us, right? And I got letters signed by John and by Dennis agreeing to have this DNA test done. And my lawyer—
By your co-defendants, right?
Correct, right, because I'm not doing this just for me. I mean, this is a frame job. It's not like, so we all agree, and my lawyer filed a motion, the judge denied it. And then my lawyer went on his own writing campaign to the DA. And finally, on the eve of when New York State Legislature was getting ready to sign the post-conviction statute 440 to allow DNA testing, the prosecutors or the DA's office finally agreed to do the DNA testing, and that's why the DNA testing occurred in 93, 94, 95. Or otherwise, if that legislation wasn't going to be on the books, they would have probably continued to refuse it, even though, you know, people at that point were being exonerated because of the results of DNA tests. These people fought tooth and nail against this DNA test, and then when we finally got the DNA test going, the judge finds it unreliable, like we mentioned before. But, you know, I always had this hope, right? And then, you know, things started falling together with more people getting involved. And the more people I got involved, the more confident I felt that I was going to one day be vindicated.
But let me ask you, I mean, I guess what I'm trying to figure out is, it seems like it would have been really easy for you to either give up or get consumed by anger, because this was not a situation where it was a mistake. This was a situation where you were deliberately prosecuted and persecuted by people who did you incredible harm and also denied justice to the family, who must have been fucking devastated. I mean, like, as a father, I can't imagine, you know, what they went through. And then there's no justice for them either. So is there a secret that you could share that allowed you to sort of find this extra gear, and instead of banging your head against the wall or doing whatever, you channeled this, it seems like.
This is gonna sound strange, but I still use this line today. It could be worse, right? And I was facing a level of adversity that the average person could never understand. While I was inside, I read a lot. But I didn't read, you know, novels. I read a lot of nonfiction. I read a lot about World War II. I read a lot about POWs. So I'm putting in my brain, like, okay, me doing this life sentence for something I didn't do, how does that compare to an 18-year-old kid that is pushed onto the beach in Normandy and, you know, lives for 5 minutes and he's gone, right? Or a POW in the Philippines that is being tortured every day. So I'm putting my adversity
in context,
kind of perspective of, you know, adversity that other people in worse situations that I was in, right? At least I was getting, you know, 3 meals a day. I wasn't being physically tortured. Nobody was pulling my fingernails out. I put it all in perspective of, you know, a POW in the Philippines or a POW in Vietnam. And I got it in my brain. Well, at the end of the day, I don't belong here, but it could be worse.
And John's too modest to talk about this, but I'm going to say he also spent a lot of time when he was in prison trying to make it a less horrible place for other people, and also helping people on the outside. So among the many things he did, like when I first talked to his prison counselor, she just blew up my phone with, oh my God, John, he's just incredible. I want him to go home, but what are we going to do without him? He was a HIV/AIDS counselor for other inmates, either on how to avoid contracting the disease or helping them deal with their diagnoses, even though he was a straight man who was HIV negative, at a time in the 80s and 90s when people were scared to talk about AIDS, much less work directly with people who were affected. He worked with mentally ill inmates, the guys that everybody thought was crazy and were pariahs at the prison, and he was just trying to help them get the medication they needed and the support they needed. And then people on the outside, I know people who John was like their phone buddy, you know, family friends and young nieces and nephews, who he would just call once a week and like talk them through their problems in school or their issues with their families, you know, all the while he's facing the most unimaginable thing any of us think we could go through. And that's just a testament to who he is and how strong he is.
I'm glad you said that, because that is an awesome thing to hear for me. I'm sure many other people who are going through whatever they're going through, to hear your perspective on that and hear then Nina, you know, adding in what you were too modest or humble to talk about. It's incredible. And I got to tell you, John, I mean, you know, it's true, too, that I think I can speak for Nina and almost any of the other 600 of us who are here at the Innocence Network Conference, who are part of the network, right? The activists, the lawyers, the social workers, the people who are just obsessed with this stuff like me. And the simple reason why is because of people like you. When someone's made aware of the quality of person that you are, and that I would say the overwhelming majority of the people, the men and women who've been exonerated, what they're made out of, it's like it only inspires us to want to do more. And that's why, for anyone who's ever asked me, you know, why you keep doing this, it's because of people like you. So, you know, what can I say? You have all my respect.
Well, I look at it from the other perspective, because, and I appreciate where you're coming from, but to me, people in Nina's shoes, they're my hero. People in your shoes, what you do for the movement, you're my hero. And everybody who supports this movement, they're my hero, right? Because if it wasn't for people like Nina and people like you, right, I'd probably still be in that 6x8.
John, I just want to ask you one more question, though, and then I am going to get to the closing. So I interviewed Gloria Killian on the podcast. And she said, she's an amazing, amazing woman, very powerful presence. And wrongfully convicted, served 17 and a half years. I encourage people to listen to her episode of the podcast. But she said something that I think is important to hear, and I want to get your perspective on this. She said to anyone listening, if you don't think this can happen to you, it can happen to you. Would you agree with that?
Most definitely. And you could be walking down the street one day, just minding your business, and get surrounded by cops, and before you know it, you're thrown into the system, and you don't have a clue as to what's going on until all of a sudden you're brought in front of a judge, and you're being charged with whatever, and you're totally clueless as to what happened. And in a lot of these wrongful conviction cases, that's exactly what occurred. I mean, because if somebody thinks that this can't happen to them, they're totally wrong, because being wrongfully convicted can happen to anybody. Anybody. And it doesn't have anything to do with race, gender, anything. And I wouldn't wish this on my worst enemy to have to go through something like this. Because no matter what you do after you're exonerated, you carry it for the rest of your life. I mean, it doesn't go away.
Well, yeah, you can't get back those years and all the things that you missed, the birthdays, the family stuff, just everything. I mean, nobody can give you those back. If we could, we would. But that being said, it's amazing to see you making the most out of it. And you're in Florida, you're enjoying some sun and some palm trees or whatever it is down there. And I'm really glad that things are going your way. And now comes my favorite part of the show, which is the part of the show where I, first of all, thank both of you, Nina Morrison and John Restivo, for joining me, sharing your thoughts on wrongful conviction. So thank you both for being here. And now I get to sit back and listen and just leave the microphones on for final thoughts. And I'm going to let Nina go first because it would be appropriate for you to close the show. So you're batting cleanup, so to speak. So anyway, so Nina.
Well, all I want to say is, you know, your listeners have gotten a flavor for who John is and what he's gone through. But one of the things that's really special about John is what he's done after he's been out and how much he's done. He's done a lot to help get people registered to vote in Florida, to feed the homeless, to make his community better. And his personal journey is told in this beautiful, beautiful feature story in the New Yorker magazine by a writer named Ariel Levy. And if people Google John's name, and the title, I think, is The Price of a Life, and it's all about the deep pain and suffering that he went through. If your listeners are interested in the human toll that wrongful convictions take, Ariel told his story in a very revealing and intimate way, and I hope folks will check it out.
John?
I just take it one day at a time. I wake up in the morning and I just say to myself, no day in paradise. I'm just glad to be free. And if I can do something to help my community, or if I feel or if I see something that needs to be done, I try to help. And I was involved in 2008 in this huge voter registration thing that we had going in Florida, and we just got passed, we got an amendment passed where felons are going to be allowed to vote. So now we're going to have to start getting felons registered to vote for our upcoming election. And when I'm asked, I have a group of friends, and when I'm asked to help, I'm more than happy to help. And I want to thank you for having us here.
All I can say is thank you both again, and thank you all for listening, and I'll see you next week on Wrongful Conviction.
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA wherever you get your BBC podcasts, if you dare.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.
Are you ready to take charge of your health journey? Look no further than Trinity School of Natural Health. With their flexible online programs, you can receive the comprehensive education you need to care for your loved ones or step into the thriving field of natural health. Why choose Trinity? Because their programs offer more than just coursework. You'll interact with experienced instructors, connect with like-minded peers, and even participate in optional live events to hone your skills. If you've ever thought about becoming a certified natural health professional, the CNHP program at Trinity School of Natural Health is the perfect certification course. You'll equip yourself with the knowledge and skills to make a real difference in the lives of others. Turn your passion for natural health into a rewarding career. Visit trinityschool.org today to learn more about the Certified Natural Health Professional Certification Program. Go to trinityschool.org. That's trinityschool.org. Trinity School of Natural Health. Transform your life. Transform the world.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kid's PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky?
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.